Are you ready to finally finish that book draft or revision? Are you itching to learn new tools or frameworks to make the writing process easier? Are you looking for a side gig to add to your repertoire? Author Accelerator's Book Coach Certification Program is a robust and exciting way to learn new writing and publishing skills. Their certification course in fiction or nonfiction includes hundreds of hours of video lessons, workshops, and practice exercises, all about researching the marketplace, querying agents, project management for your book idea, and more. They're great, and I say that as someone who's done this. Many writers come to the program looking to up their writing game. Writer and certified book coach Trevor Brooks says, "This course changed my life. I feel more confident than ever in my ability to develop a manuscript as both a writer and a coach that will attract the attention of an agent and a publisher." So, if you're ready to try something new and join a community of writers and book coaches helping writers, visit authoraccelerator.com/writing to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is #AmWriting, the podcast that talks about all the things. Writing, short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, pitches, proposals. As I say every time you hear my voice starting this off, this is the podcast about sitting down and getting the work done. I'm KJ Dell'Antonia. I'm the author of the novels In Her Boots and The Chicken Sisters, as well as the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent. I'm a former editor at the New York Times of the Motherlode, and I am solo today, except for my guest. I am super excited about this, so let me head us right into the topic. Tarina Elizabeth Bell, my guest today, has been writing all her life. Her first short story was published in a literary magazine when she was in college, almost 30 years ago, and she's published many since and won multiple awards. She's also written for more than 100 publications, including The Atlantic, The Guardian, Boston Globe, Smithsonian, Playboy, Mystery Tribune, and Santa Monica Review. I put all those in there because I wanted y'all to see the range we're talking about here. But she could not find a publisher for her debut novel or debut short story collection. As she put it when she reached out to me, it wasn't for lack of trying. Her novel was turned down by 64 agents. That novel, Recursion, is stream of consciousness. It plays around with time. The short story collection, Tell Me What You See, is a short story collection. In other words, they're both literary. So, Tarina turned to small presses and sold both her novel and her short story collection within 2 weeks. That's why she's here! As y'all know, if you're regular listeners, Jess, Serena, and I are all either independently published or have been with the Big Five. Jess has done some more academic style writing. We've all written for small publications, but the small press experience is not one that we have. So, welcome, Tarina. We're going to talk small presses.
Woohoo!
Yeah, it's your turn to finally talk now.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I'm really excited.
Yeah. It's funny, while you were doing the intro, I was thinking about all of these things, like when you're talking about the range of where all I have published. And it's funny because when I first approached you, I think one of the many topics that we were talking about was how a lot of the advice that is out there for writers wanting to get published is very, very Big Five geared. And, you know, I just see all of these, and not necessarily newbie writers, like one lady I'm thinking about, she's been writing her whole life, you know, minored in creative writing in college, and but just people who are kind of new to the publishing or trying to get published scene, and they all get so obsessed with platform. And when you were reading all of that out, I was sitting there thinking, you know, I've got nearly 6,000 Twitter followers. You know, you're reading out all these publications, you know, like Washington Post and all the ones that you're supposed to have. You know, a lot of that writing was even on the publishing industry. So you meet all sorts of people going to BEA and all these other conferences that may or may not come back when COVID is completely over. And it's funny, platform did not help me one stinking whit. And it's funny because there's just such an obsession with it. And when you go over to the small press world, they could care less. They don't really care how many Twitter followers you have. They don't really care, you know, where you have and have not published before. Now, a lot of them have literary magazines that they also run. And for both of the titles that you were talking about, I published with their literary magazines first.
Okay, well, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because I wanted to come back to what you just said, which is platform didn't help you find a publisher. And, you know, I mean, the truth about platform is it does not help sell books necessarily either. It can. It depends. But there was a big article in the New York Times recently that I will attempt to find. And let me just throw a little note in the show notes so I can link it for people. About how a really famous singer had a book come out and the name will come to me. I actually used her name in something I was writing recently. And, you know, she has squazillions of followers and the book just didn't, you know, it didn't hit. I guess it's not what they wanted for her. Presumably they want music. Others have found the same thing. And just regular people that I know have talked on a variety of podcasts about how, you know, the platform that they had created didn't sell the book.
Yeah.
So I think that's not an unusual experience, and it's funny that publishers get so head up about it. So I'm really interested to hear that the smaller presses are not, or at least publishers claim to be so head up.
See, I think it's the agents that are big on it, and the publishers just see it on the stuff that agents send over. And
oh,
I mean,
gotcha.
like think about Justine Bateman when she came out with Fame. What was that, like 5 years ago? It was a very nice feature spread in Vanity Fair, but it never, and part of this may have been because it was with
Didn't even know she had a book.
Well, see, that's the thing. And part of it was with the Kazik, which is a wonderful, wonderful independent press. So that may have been the difference in, you know, like it being independent versus Big Five. But who on the planet has bigger platform than Justine Bateman, for Pete's freaking sake, you know?
Yeah.
Didn't help.
I want to note, before we get into talking, and we're going to really dig into this small press thing, because, you know, just to flash for the readers or for the listeners where we're going, small press, you got to find a good one. And some places describe themselves as small presses that are not. So we're absolutely going to cover that. But when I was getting ready to do this interview, I was noting of the 10 National Book Award finalists for 2022, two are with small presses and four are books of short stories. So those are both things, you know, that it's sort of commonly, first of all, short stories are commonly known as difficult to get publisher for.
Period.
And secondly, yeah, there's two, there's something called Beacon Press and also Soho Press. Soho Press is a little bigger, and Beacon Press I think is also not a small press, but they're not Big Five. And 2 out of 10, that's a lot. And yeah, even of the rest, the number, there was Macmillan was one, and somebody else that's not Big Five, I don't remember.
Well, now, did you include university presses in that? Because I don't think of them in the same category as small press, but they're definitely not Big Five. Like Secret Lives of Church Ladies was published by the University of West Virginia Press. You know, and it was a national book. Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I would conclude those as things you should look into, but just the National Book Award finalists, those were the only non-Macmillan, non-Big Five slash things I also think of as relatively close to the Big Five, which I guess would include Macmillan. I mean, do I still have that up here? Yeah, there's Penguin, Soho Press, Macmillan, Penguin, Beacon, Penguin, Simon & Schuster, Norton. And, oh, Astra, there's another one.
Yeah.
So that's 10 literary, obviously, literary books, and not, you know, not all of them by any means were Big Five. So I love that we're going to talk about this. We're going to dig in. So I gave the basics of the journey to small presses, but I would love it if you walked us through a little bit how you made that call.
To publish with them, you mean?
No, well, to start looking with small presses.
Well, it's funny. I have always been, you know, like you were talking about, I published my first short story when I was in college. I had my first literary journal publication, period, a poem when I was 15. And so I was told, and I'm not like the advice in the 70s, and I'm not old enough to, I was born in the 70s, but I'm not old enough to certainly remember literary advice from them. But the advice in the 70s was, it was kind of like, if you publish in a literary journal, you'll be found. Like how in the 1980s, we all thought, you know, you go to the mall and you look pretty and they're going to make you a Ford model, you know, because somebody's going to grab you from the mall. So there was always this kind of thing that I was taught by my high school English teachers that was reiterated when I was in college, that if you published with the right literary journals, that that is how an agent or a big five publisher would find you. And it's funny because I've been to mixers. I live here in New York City, and I'll go to mixers here where there are folks in the big five, and I'll start talking about what we consider to be big literary journals, and they'd never even heard of them. And I'm like, okay, so this mall analogy doesn't work. But at the same time, there's a conference called the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. And they have an annual conference that is kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like, I don't want to say summer camp, but it's kind of like prom for literary magazine editors. And also like a lot of MFA and creative writing people go, which of course, many of those programs have journals. And they had their conference in Philadelphia. And I thought, okay, you know, this link between getting a book published and publishing in these journals isn't really what I've been taught that it is for like the last 20 years. And, you know, it's like I've been sitting here trying to publish in these journals over and over again. But I thought the conference is in Philadelphia. That is like an hour train ride from New York. I actually got an award to pay for the conference admittance. And I'm like, you know, I'll just go down there and network with literary journals because getting published in them doesn't hurt. And as somebody who's primarily a short story writer, you know, short story collections as a whole book tend to not get published, which I'm very, very grateful that mine will be. But I thought I still want to get those out in those journals. So I went down there. And both of the publishers, I sold my novel to one and then the short story collection to another. They both had booths at the event. And I thought, well, I'll go by and I'll just say thank you for publishing me in their literary magazine. And it's eerie because they're two very, very similar stories. They both said, we love your stuff. We want more. You know, you do know that we're primarily a book publisher. If you've got anything book length, please, please, please send it to us. So, yeah, so I went on and I pulled out the novel for ELJ Editions and sent it over to them. I think it took her 3 days to accept. and that's not always the way that it works. That's not a small press typical thing. That's a one-on-one personal connection kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like there are other small presses that my novel had been setting in their queue for like, I don't know, maybe a year and a half, and they were still unread and submittable. You know, so it depends on staff size and all sorts of other things. But Whiskey Tit, which is a wonderful, I can't be more grateful or offer more praise for having connected with them. They accepted my short story collection maybe a month after the event. So that's kind of how it went, was that I made the personal connection with them. And on the novel especially, I had given up. I trunked it maybe 2 years ago. You know, because I just
You had done the regular querying agent route before that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did it. And I had some, you know, they ask for full, they ask for additional chapters, and then they ghost you. That's how it goes. You know, but it's just my writing with both titles. I didn't think of them as experimental while I was writing. I was just writing. And then once they were done, you know, friends and beta readers looked at them and were like, you know, this is experimental, right? And good luck getting an experimental short story collection to sell over at Penguin. You know, like that's just not going to happen.
Yeah. I want to back up first and ask you. So I think a lot of our listeners wouldn't even know how to begin. So I feel like if you don't read something, you're probably not the right person to submit to something. But literary journals might be an exception, although you should absolutely read it before you submit to it. So I think there, if you're a reader of short stories and a writer of short stories and of the kinds of things that literary journals publish, maybe you don't necessarily have to be a regular with a specific literary journal to read it. So the question that I was going to ask you is how, when you went out to look for literary journals to start submitting your work to, how did you start looking?
You can't read them all. There's too many
exactly.
of them, and it's too expensive, to be quite frank. You know, I mean, you're spending, they're not magazine prices. They're more like,
right.
They're more like what book prices were before the pandemic. You know,
and if you hit the right bookstore, you'll find a few, but it's going to be
right, not as many.
Tin House and Bellevue. No, probably not even that. Yeah, they're going to be some very select few. So,
yeah.
Right. So you can't just sort of wander in like you might with magazines, although you can't really do that anymore either. Where are you going to look?
You know, it's funny, since I started submitting when I was 15, I don't even remember how I actually started with Writer's Market, which I don't recommend anybody use, because it's a book that's only published once a year. And I don't even know if they still print it or not. But then I just had pretty much the same people.
I think
on
they
my
do.
List.
And I think you can get it at the library.
Yeah.
But I don't know how it is on literary journals. All right. Well, we'll table that. Anybody has.
I was going to say, I think
finding
Twitter and Duotrope. And then there's something else called the Grindr, the Submission Grindr, where it's like a database where you can go in and type, you know, experimental, no submission fee. And it'll pull up links to folks' submission guidelines.
Is that just spelled Grindr, like Grind?
Yes, like a coffee grinder.
Okay. Cool. So, oh, okay. All right. I'll find those and link them up in the show notes,
yeah,
everybody.
Those may help some folks.
Cool.
So, but as
and
far,
I'll link the
oh,
Association of Writers and Writing Programs
yeah,
as well.
But as far as finding literary presses to publish with, there's something called Small Fair, and it's spelled S-M-O-L, like in all capitals, Fair. And it
okay.
runs concurrent with that AWP conference that I was talking about earlier,
uh-huh.
except it's free to attend and it's all online. And what I did was they have a bunch of readings, and I attended as many of those readings as I could, and I paid attention to which presses they were with. And the irony is, my story collection, Tell Me What You See, is publishing with Whiskey Tit in December. And when I heard the guy read from Whiskey Tit on the Small Fair, I was like, oh, they're not a match for me.
Huh.
And I think it's because, like, whereas, like if you look at Berkeley, which is one of the imprints of the Big Five, I can tell a Berkeley book. It's going to be historical romance, but not as obvious that it's a romance, because it's not really chick lit, and it's very heavy on the historical, very heavy on like a female lead, a strong female lead. And then she just happens to kind of fall in love with a guy, you know, like, and I'm like, I can pick it up and I can read it. And I'm like, oh, that's a Berkeley book. You know,
right.
like they're somewhat smart, you know, that sort of thing.
Some Big Five imprints are like,
yeah, that. Yeah. But that doesn't happen as much with small presses. Like Whiskey Tit goes for experimental. They go for intelligent. They publish even a little bit of submersive lit, which is what this was. And that's not me. You know, but it's, they say that they basically specialize in printing stuff that isn't going to fit easy on a bookshelf. Like my short story collection, a lot of the stories are written in both pictures and words. Like sometimes the dialogue is nothing but emoji, you know? So, yeah. So that's something that, you know, is it an art book? Because I've got original drawings and stuff in there, or is it a short story collection? You know, so like, that's just kind of an example of, you don't necessarily know how to code it or where in a bookstore it would go, but it's still something valid. So that's why you get so much
difference.
So it's hard
to find comps. Which is, you know, when we're talking commercial publishing, we talk comps all the time. And if you're sort of struggling in that area, then small presses may be more interested and more willing to sort of not expect you to be, you know, where the crawdad sings meets Harry Potter.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, you know, write that.
Right. Like it's just insane. You know, it's like it's and I just see some of these people struggling for comps during which they don't have. What was that thing on Twitter that they used to do? That was like a, you know what I'm talking
about?
Like
Pitch Fest.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, and you just see some of them and it's like the original Charmed series meets the Bible. And you're like, you really had to stretch for that. Like independents, they don't even ask for comps. They don't want them. You know, now an example like a Camcat, they ask for comps. They're a larger independent press, but it's because they publish genre fiction. So they want to know, and that's also kind of an example, like, are they a commercial small press or are they a literary small press? You know, and the more
Camcat.
Yes.
Wait, I'm yeah. Spell, please.
C A M and then C A T, and both C's are capitalized.
All right.
I've got a friend
which is
Michael Bradley is published with them.
Cool. So there are more genres. So that's a good moment to pause and talk about distinguishing between small presses and so we've talked a lot on this program about being independently published, and we all know Serena is independently published and also has sometimes independently published other writers in her genre, actually in her world. That's a different thing that she's done. But there are also, when you start Googling small press, you're going to come up with people that are basically people that are basically offering to let you pay them to independently publish your book. And that is a very different thing. So let's talk about what makes a small press a small press.
Well, to me, those are vanity publishers, or they're people, they're companies that help ease you into self-publishing. And self-publishing is perfectly valid. Ulysses was originally self-published.
Right. And But just to stop, because it's something we really worry about. You can independently publish without paying anyone. You can independently publish and by paying,
right?
You know, and you probably should, people to help you with editorial and covers. You can maybe work with one stop that will help you with editorial and covers, but you need to be aware that anything that they're promising you with regard to distribution is something you must check out very carefully. So just to sort of put a little point on that, that's a different thing. Anybody who wants you to pay them,
right,
is not a small press.
Right.
Fair?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And you know, we're going to set aside the idea, you know, the question of which of those businesses are legit and which are not, because man, that's a hard one to parse. Not where we are.
When it's also
there,
not
we go.
Yeah, right. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Small presses aren't going to ask you for money.
Right, right. They're just not. They might ask for a $3 submission fee.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Like,
no. That.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know.
That's a reading fee, and that's because otherwise they just get.
Well, and it's inundated. It's funny that you say that, because even my own father. I'm originally from Sinking Fork, Kentucky, which is a very rural. You know, very very rural. Like, we don't even have a post office anymore. Something my grandfather used to lament a lot about, it having been taken away. I thought when he was a boy, but turns out when his father was a boy. You know, so needless to say, there is not a bookstore for miles and miles and miles. So my very, very sweet father wanted to know if he could sell copies of my book out of his car, you know, and could the publisher give him, you know, like X number of copies, because he wanted to sell them to friends. And, you know, and I guess when he goes to his regular morning coffee with all the other old men in town, you know. And it's funny because he asked me, and this is like, I signed the contract for this, I think in April, and we're recording this in very, very late September. Hopefully it's okay for viewers or for listeners to know that. And it was
they're
just
going to hear this in about a week.
Okay, great. So it was just last week, which for our listeners would be about 2 weeks ago. And my dad said, he said, well, before I tell your publisher how many of these I want for the car, how much are they charging you for them? And I was just like, Daddy, you know, I was like, no, I'm like, they're paying me.
I have to stop you, because my dad did the same thing.
Oh, really?
Back when not quite, but and I am from Kansas, and my dad's a little more, you know, it's not quite Sinking Fork. But my dad, I was writing for the New York Times to audition for the thing that I eventually ended up editing, which is a blog at the time. This was a long time ago. And I'm telling my parents, because I'm thrilled, right? And we're going to put aside the comments they made about the liberal media there, which I'm sure you will also understand.
Mine's also very political, so
Yeah. So, and he's like, you know, you shouldn't let them take advantage of you like this. You should not be doing this for free. And
right.
I'm like, Dad, they're so paying me. I mean, they're paying me more than I'd been paid to do it. I mean, I was just like,
well, and it's
what do you think?
It's
come
funny
on.
Because I explained royalties and advances to them when I signed the contract, you know, so you would think, but my father, like, I wound up, and this is the thing, some small presses do advances and some do not. And advances are typically going to be smaller than they are with Big Five.
Yep.
But the royalties, at least from what friends of mine have told me, that they probably shouldn't have because of the confidentiality in their own contracts.
I don't think there's confidentiality in contracts. I think we just don't talk about it because it's often embarrassing how small they are.
Well, but that's like the royalties that I've seen with small press are much higher, sometimes even double than the royalty with the Big Five. And it's because that tends to be the end of it where you make your money as opposed to an advance. And on one hand, I don't have the pressure on me of earning an advance out because the advances are typically smaller. But I'd explained all this to my parents, and my dad, you know, bless his heart, you know, he kept getting confused. He's like, so there's two different ways to make them. And I finally just said, Dad, they're paying me a commission. You know, because it's like a percentage or whatever of what sells. And, you know, and I was like, and they're giving me this much up front. And then once I've earned that much in commission, I'll get more money per book. And so I think that that may be where he got the idea of like I was having to pay for them or something.
Right.
You know, but it was just very, very sweet. And it also, I think, is proof that we need more bookstores in Western Kentucky. You know, I don't want my dad to have to get a business license for his back seat, but...
Well, you know, selling books out of the trunk of your car is a tried and true way of succeeding. It actually is. Well, many of us do it.
Right. So. And that is one thing to be aware of also. If a writer decides to go small press, even if there is a bookstore in your town, they may not carry that press. You know, so it's something that, like, you know, like we were talking about Berkeley earlier. You know, most bookstores will probably just buy one of each from Berkeley because they're Berkeley. You know, and if they have or have not heard of Whiskey Tit or Malarkey Books or Alternating Current or what you will, you know, it may be a little bit more difficult to get into your local bookstore. But
well, you often even see this in these National Book Award nominees and place things like that. A book will suddenly get a lot of press and no one can buy it. You know, you probably can't go to your bookstore. I'll put the link to the nominees for the National Book Award in the show notes. And also I will own up front that there's only even one on there that I would even think about reading. That's not my jam.
Right.
But you know, I'm sure that if you go out looking for, if you go looking for the ones that are Penguin, you're probably going to find them. But if you go out looking for, The Town of Babylon from Astra in your local bookstore? I don't know.
I've never heard of it, personally.
I haven't heard a lot of these, which is another sort of a topic.
Right. But that's wonderful that they are reading across the board, you know, and not just pulling their awards from the ones that get, I mean, and that's something like a lot of people don't realize is that the publisher has to pay to have your book in the front of the bookstore. They don't just put it there because you're the one that likes it best. And, you know, that's with a small press, they're going to have to go to the right section to pick it up. It's not going to be in the front. But
yeah, although there's less of that than there used to be. Barnes & Noble won't do it anymore.
Oh, really?
They rarely do it. Yep. Yeah, so the world is changing.
That's promise.
In that particular respect. And what you just said made me think of another way to come up with literary journals, which is to go and grab the best short stories of... for any given year.
I used to do that when I was younger. I'd go to Barnes & Noble because at least the one on the Upper West Side of New York, they've got a big area where you can sit. And it's usually like where they do author signings. And if you sit there when they're not doing an author signing, I used to flip to the back of the book where they had the honorable mentions.
Perfect, because it's a much longer list.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good way to do that. So when it came to... working with the small press, can you tell us some of the ways that, I mean, you haven't had the big press experience, so you've already talked about how the advance is undoubtedly smaller, and although big presses can give some pretty small advances,
right,
too.
And the royalties
and
are
the
higher.
Royalty rate is hopefully higher. Did you have an agent to make these deals?
I didn't. And it's funny because during contract negotiations, I was like, this is why people have one, you know, because it's helpful with that. However, a lot of agents will not. And that's one thing I think that made it difficult for me to get an agent with the novel originally is because you do not have to have an agent to go to small presses. In some small presses, there are very, very few of them that will not talk to you if you have an agent because they believe agents get in the way. And then the bulk of them, you know, there's some of them that they just kind of quietly prefer not to have to deal with an agent, because they worry that, and it's not the case with Whiskey Tit, but they worry that the agent kind of gets in the way artistically because the art part is more important to them than the commercial. Like, for example, there's one press called Malarkey Books that occasionally they'll have a day that they'll tweet that they'll just give their books away for free. You know, you just go to the website that day and you can have the books for free.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it's because they want them read. Now, as somebody who makes my living 100% for writing, hell no, please do not give my book away for free. you know, like I want it read, but I also want to eat.
Yes.
And agents, I'm sure, would probably have kind of the same feeling because agents only make what their actual commission is, to go and use that word again. But, agents are not.
So you didn't have an agent to look. Yeah. So you didn't have an agent to look at the contract. Did you get a lawyer or anything?
I didn't. I used the Author Guild model contract. And then I compared it side by side. And then also I used to work in legal translation and do different things like that. And so, you know, but if somebody didn't recognize the terms in a contract, like I own two businesses, so I'm used to what normal language and contract terms are. But if somebody did not have that experience, they might want to get a lawyer. But I think, I don't know, I think you probably need a lawyer that specifies in that type of work, you know, as opposed to just, you know, like where I grew up, you've just got lawyers.
Being a member of the Authors Guild is a huge help. You can get a lot of help.
Yeah. And their model contract is actually online for free. You don't have to be a member.
Oh, nice.
Or at least it was, you know, earlier this year or so.
Right.
Save a couple $100 for people.
I always still say you should be a member because the Authors Guild is great and can really come through for you when you need them. We've talked about that before on this show, how we've seen them step up and help writers out.
Their emergency fund is absolutely wonderful. Like if somebody's in a financial pinch or something.
Well, and even, I don't remember the details, but like if you're having an argument with Amazon, the Authors Guild is going to be able to get Amazon to pay attention in a way that you individually are not. So there's reasons.
Yeah.
There's reasons to be in that. And we love them on the podcast. So you've got your contracts, and now you're working with them to get the books done. How was the editorial and publication experience? I know you're not done publishing yet.
Well, it's funny. It's one thing that I would recommend would be to look at the size of the press, but then also because that will tell you sometimes what their bandwidth is for support. But that being said, some presses can actually have fewer people working there and offer more support. So if you go on and like you look at their Twitter profile, their website, things like that, like if the market, like how big do they seem as opposed to how big they are? And that will tell you a lot about the way that they handle their marketing and stuff. But Whiskey Tit has been absolutely wonderful. My personality with Miet, who is the publisher there, we've got personalities that work really well to where she kind of knows which ones of my emails need responses and which ones are just me giving her information. And there are times when I hear from her every day and it's wonderful. Like one of the things that works out really well is that like it's possible at a big five to be the lead title. And you're the one that probably got the largest advance of the year. They're throwing all of their marketing at you. And then the other books that they're publishing that year, they're just kind of sitting there quietly with their cats, you know, because there's not as much support that is lent to them because these big, what they consider the bigger titles, because they put more money behind them, get all the attention. With a small press, it's even. Like every title is the lead title. So like Miet has set it up to where we're doing a speaking offsite with Brooklyn Book Festival, which is this weekend. And for our listeners will be, I think, last weekend. But that's something that I wouldn't have even known how to get set up. And, you know, like I reached out to you directly to get this podcast. So we're both working on getting Tell Me What You See marketed. And it's kind of like in tandem. you know, so she's just really, really, really together. But I imagine if you had the one lead person who was not together, it might be a miserable experience, you know, because it all comes down to, and it's the same way, like if you're at a big five and you and your editor do or you don't get along. You know, like I've got a friend who published with Hachette and she would call her marketing people and yell at them every day. Well, they stopped marketing her book and I don't blame them.
Imagine that.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so it kind of all comes down to how you work with people and that sort of thing. So I would advise, and then two, with me being able to go up to the booth and everything before I sent the manuscript that was then accepted, you know, you're able to get to know more than just the kind of email personalities, because we're all a little bit different in writing.
It sounds like you also submitted to small presses that you didn't go to visit and talk to them at the press. So it sounds like you've also had the sort of submission experience with small presses.
Yes. There was a point where I realized that the novel was just not going to publish with the big five, that it just wasn't. You know, when you hit 60 some odd rejections, you know, that's when there's either something wrong with the book, wrong with you, wrong with the industry, you know, whatever. And I just realized, you know, like I'm never going to publish with Berkeley. And I love Berkeley books. They're what I read in leisure time, but they're just not the kind of stuff that I write. I'm trying to remember, what did you originally ask me? Because that was the beginning of me trying to answer it. And then I just got so meandering.
I asked you what the submission process with small presses had been like.
Yeah.
I just also want to clarify, you had pursued an agent. You didn't sort of throw yourself at the big five directly, because that's not a thing that one does.
Well, I did at FSG because mm-hmm. I went to an event at New York Society Library where the publisher of FSG said that they still
Which
go.
Which is Farrar, Straus,
yeah,
Giroux.
And the reason I say FSG is because you're the one who can pronounce that and I'm not. But their publisher actually spoke and said that they still go through the slush pile every Friday night. And so when I couldn't get an agent, I was just like, well, screw them. And I sent that one in directly. And I actually think that they have stopped doing that, because that was like 4 or 5 years ago. And I actually think it was probably like hazing for the interns. but I did to them.
So one try like that, lots of more than 60 agents, no bites, and you start submitting your stuff.
I even tried agents in the United Kingdom. Like that's where I started going with it, because I don't know, the movies give me an impression that they're smarter over there.
It's the accent. Yeah.
Yeah. But
sounds good.
The traditional way to get published with small press is on their website. They will have submission guidelines, just like a literary journal does. And usually they have you go over to something called Submittable, which I don't recall seeing agents use. Like agents use whatever.
Some of them do.
Software.
I've seen it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And some of them make you pay $3. Some of them don't. I'm in the camp of never pay anybody to read your work. You know, like it should be the other way around. But, you know, $3 is
And
not.
I'll just stop and say that if you're seeing a reading fee like that, like $3, then, and you're worried about it, the thing to do is to sort of go out into the world, do some web searches, check Twitter, check, and see if other people have gotten good responses. But, you know, if you're a racket and you're charging people $3 a read, you're not a very good racket. I have some other ideas for you that might be more lucrative.
You'd be surprised. I can't remember their name. Oh, Pank. Pank has just become very controversial in the industry, and they're kind of like,
what is Pank?
It was Roxane Gay's magazine that she started. Mm-hmm. Like it's PANK in all capitals, but they become really controversial because, I don't quote
because of the reading fees.
Well,
okay,
but
so, well,
also,
you're getting quoted because you're on camera, you know,
but
apparently there's been a controversy there.
Yeah, it's not just, and I kind of mean don't quote me as like an expression because I may get the number wrong, but for I want to say between the last 2 to 3 years, they have not read a single submission and they've continued to charge. And when you've got like 1,000 of those suckers coming in every week, every month, it can become a scam pretty quickly.
I guess so. All right. Well, fine. Start your $3 a read scams if you have a big name that you can associate them with.
But you're right.
But
it's a difficult way.
If you were going to submit to them, you would then, what I'm suggesting is suggesting is do some checking yourself before you throw your $3 out there. And then you would see that and you'd be like, oh, okay, I'm going to give my $3.
Right.
You know, right. Someone, because other magazines really do have more of a setup where it's like,
yeah,
you have someone reading these and they're getting the dollar.
Right. Like New England Review is legit. Paris Review is legit.
Yeah. I mean, when I was taking submissions for the Motherlode blog at the New York Times, obviously I wasn't like a dollar to submit to me, but I would get thousands of things a week. And you know, that's a lot to do if you're not getting paid, which I of course was getting paid to do. So, all right. So the traditional way is to submit through their pages. And then I guess you wait. It sounds like you didn't,
Some of them I waited like 2 years and then I just wound up withdrawing it, you know, so it just takes them a while.
So submit and send short stories in and, you know, try to become same as everything. Try to become a part of the universe of the places that you want to publish you.
Yeah, like the Bible talks about throwing your bread upon the water and then eventually, like, I assume, I don't remember the rest of the verse, but I assume like a duck or something will come by and eat the right one.
And then you get to catch the duck and eat it.
But the literary journal route.
That doesn't sound very good.
It's very, very odd.
It's a duck eat duck world out there.
It is. And sometimes it's even a goose eat duck world, which just throws everything off base. But the literary journal route, like it's.
For your Bible education, come here.
Hey, I'm from Kentucky, right? I've got to quote the Bible at least once. But the literary journal route, it worked for me, but that's really, really, really rare. And it's funny because I've got a lot of friends that go to AWP and like all of them have said, you're the only person we've ever known who went to AWP and came away with a contract, you know, so it's the, whatever the 1% is that happens to people. You know, whether it's coming down with some sort of really bizarre illness that has you bedridden for 4 months, and this only happens to 4% of people who get the flu, you know, or only 4% of people get a contract at AWP. Like if something only happens to like 1% or 4% of people, it happens to me. So I'm not saying that that's the way that you, dear listener, are going to get a contract is by going to this.
However,
but it's what
if you don't go, you're guaranteed not to be.
Right.
That 1 or 4%.
Right.
So I guess that's why you're casting the bread.
Right. And I did get to skip the queue. I mean, I did wind up with 2 contracts in, you know, like a month or so or whatever I told you, but you know, so whereas if I had just sent it in on the internet, I'd be sitting here. So like a duck on the water.
I hope presumably some things that get submitted that way. I mean, I would imagine that it's like submitting to, a magazine without a contact, and that the thing to do is probably to start trying, as I said, to make yourself a part of that literary journal's world so that, you know, so that of that 100 things that they have in there, they actually scroll through looking for your name.
But it is odd because like I went to Thriller Fest, I went to Book Expo America, which doesn't exist anymore, but used to be the largest conference in the publishing industry. For Big Five and a lot of small presses also came to it. You know, I went to RWA, which is Romance Writers of America, which I don't even write romance, but I went to all of these conferences for networking with the Big Five, and networking didn't help me there. So, you know, it's interesting that I mean, really the two sides of the industry do the same thing. They publish books, you know, but it's just interesting that, you know, like they say that meeting people helps. It emphatically helped with small press, and I just met some cool people with Big Five.
Well, and you know, it might have helped there. You did the work,
right?
You got the luck. That's how we always say it is on the podcast. You don't get the luck unless you've done the work, and how that luck plays out, you know, who knows? Well, this has been great. Let's pause for a second, and then we're going to come back and talk about what we've been reading. All right. I hope you're ready. I know you listen, so I'll bet you are. Tell me something great that you have been reading lately.
Me? I read so many things. I've been reading a lot of Edith Wharton lately.
Okay, this is awesome. I love it.
Yeah,
cool.
I love her. And it's funny because I'm getting into her minor works and I'm reading, I think it's called A Glimpse of the Moon. I don't know, my brain has been a bit frazzled because I'm trying to do publicity for the book coming out and then trying to remember to write myself. But it's funny because a lot of her minor work, it's an awful lot like Sun at the Front also. You know, and it's like she just keeps showing all these vapid people. And then at the end, it's just like, bam. And it's funny because she pretty much is always who she is and writes the same thing. But when you compare it to like Custom of the Country, which is so much finer developed. But then on the other hand, I kind of like her shorter stuff because by putting less characterization into it, she's pretty much contributing to the vapidness of all these people that she makes. And I don't know, you might not have wanted a linguistic, I'm sorry, a literary analysis.
No, I'm actually delighted. and I'm going to sort of see your Edith Wharton and come back at you with a Shirley Jackson.
Oh.
I have been deep in her back catalog lately and, in fact, just went and ordered the sort of four-book set of her very earliest stuff, Hangs a Man, The Sundial, and The Bird's Nest. So because I've read most of the others and I'm working on some sort of horror-y stuff, but I have just been enjoying her letters and that was amazing. So kind of not dissimilar, like diving into the back catalog of someone I admire a lot, which I think is a fascinating thing to do with any writer. I, for example, just to go like in a totally different direction, we love Alexis Hall on the podcast, and he, in fact, was on. He was our guest a week or two ago, as the listeners are seeing it. And his current book is Paris Dalincourt is About to Crumble, and it is wonderful. It's a British Bake Off rom-com takeoff, and completely different from anything we've discussed today. But I happen to have gone back and read something early of his that his publisher, I think, has just I'm guessing they re-put it out from an independent publishing, and it was called Glitterland. And you can really see how far he has come and how much his work has changed. And that's a contemporary commercial rom-com writer, but the same thing of Edith Wharton and Shirley Jackson, right? You start with their early stuff and then you read the later stuff and you're like, they grew. I can grow. I am growing.
It's
wonderful.
It's crazy that you bring that up because a few years ago, I read Knight Rider, which was Robert Penn Warren's first novel. And, you know, having read like all the King's Men and stuff first, like I told my mother, because he's actually from very, very close to where I'm from. Like his grandparents lived where I'm from. And, you know, and he was born one county over. And my mom was asking about it. And I said, you can tell that he wrote it, you know, like it still reads like him, but you can also tell it's his first novel.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of the same with Shirley Jackson, reading and also reading her letters. There'll often be things in them that you recognize from the books, but they're written so much differently. And then she writes about the experience of writing them too. So that's been really wonderful. So yeah, dive back into the literary catalog of your favorites, people. That's our advice today.
I was going to say, it's also a little debilitating as a writer though, especially because I've got my debut coming out, you know? And so as I go to write other stuff and sit down, you know, when I can, you know, it's like, I just keep thinking and I'm like, but it has to be better. I'm like, it can't be just as good. It definitely can't be worse. I'm like, it has to be better. You know, and it's
welcome
just,
to why people struggle with their sophomore novels. It's a pretty common stumbling block.
Maybe
that's also why you should write it before the other stuff comes out and other people read it, so that
good
you
point.
Don't have that in your head so much.
I've got like 2.5 months. We can do it.
Yeah. Finish it. Finish something. Well, this was fantastic. I am so glad that you reached out. I'm so glad we got a chance to do this. Where can people find you best online? And I will, so, you know, we're doing this a little early. Y'all, I think, can you pre-order Tell Me What You See?
We do not have the link up yet, but it should be up soon. Like we just got our cover last week and we're finishing out layout.
And I put it in the show notes because I love it. We didn't even talk about this, but it's a really great cover. And we're starting with that, people, because Recursion is coming later.
Yeah.
TBD on the date for that.
Right. But tell me what you see is done in December.
What you see is coming out in December. So, yep.
But it Whiskey Tit is, they're just whiskeytit.com.
I'll put their link as well.
Yeah, and it's spelled with an E. And then I'm just Tarina Bell or TarinaElizabethBell.com. Okay. I guess it's confusing.
Is there anywhere you hang out social media-wise?
Twitter. I'm not on Facebook, but I do Twitter. And I sort of pretend to do TikTok. I made slight efforts at TikTok.
Stick with Twitter.
Yeah, but I'm on Twitter. I'm on Twitter every day, so.
Okay. Yep. I'll put the link to that.
Yep. All right. Thank you, KJ.
Well, thank you so much. I'm gonna take us out with our usual recommendation. Although before that, I will say that if you liked the episode, we'd love it if you popped into amwritingpodcast.com, sign up to get the weekly show notes. And I might add that if you are on that list, you would have been getting regular ride-alongs from me. I've done 3 the past couple of weeks, and I'm going to keep doing them for a while. So if you want to join us for ride-alongs, you need to be on that list, which you will find at amwritingpodcast.com. So look us up there, review us in your pod player, and in the meantime, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Writers, do you read Serena Bowen? If you don't, you should! First off, because her books are killer fun. And secondly, because everyone is a masterclass in pacing, characterization, and plot. And if you think plotting romance is easy because we know what's going to happen, then call me again after you've tried it. Her latest is A Little Too Late. Find out more at serenabowen.com.